Greetings. Welcome to the ONTIC Protective Intelligence Podcast. I'm Chuck Randolph, ONTIC's Chief Security Officer. From 30 years as a military officer and over 25 transforming corporate security teams to function beyond their traditional roles, protection, risk management, and threat mitigation have been front and center throughout my career. This podcast series will explore the turbulent world of risk, security, and protective strategies through conversations with leaders and innovators in the field. Now, on to the discussion. Dr. Charity Dean is the CEO, founder, and chairman of PHC Global, a venture-backed technology company. She founded PHC Global in August 2020 with a vision of creating a commercial-grade biosecurity software platform. Dr. Dean's 24 years in public health inspired her to develop this solution, recognizing the potential of technology to provide anticipatory intelligence for biological threats. Prior to PHC, Dr. Dean served as the Assistant Director for the California Department of Public Health, co-founded California's COVID-19 Testing Task Force, and directed the state's response to various biological threats. She was awarded Physician of the Year in 2018 and honored as one of the Women of the Year by California State Legislature. Charity holds a Doctorate of Medicine and Master of Public Health and Tropical Medicine from Tulane University and a Bachelor of Science in Microbiology from Oregon State University. Dr. Charity Dean, welcome to the ONTIC Protective Intelligence Podcast.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely. I feel like we've been talking about doing this since, I don't know, last November. And that's somehow how the cookie crumbles, as they say, or the agenda sync up. It's taken us this long, but I'm very excited to have some time with you and talk about all things biosecurity, intelligence, risks, safety, et cetera. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Very happy to be with you. Glad we made it happen.
Well, let's get right into it because I'm very curious about your background. I mean, and for those who are listening and maybe don't know Charity Dean, I mean, you have a background in both government, as a doctor, physician, and also as a startup creator, intelligence expert, biosafety. I mean, tell us a little bit about your background and maybe how all that amalgamated Charity into a passion that created PHC.
You know, I have been obsessed with one thing my whole life, really since I was about 7 years old when I got it in my head I wanted to become a physician because of the spooky biological threats that existed in the world. And, you know, studied microbiology and tropical medicine and trauma surgery and frontline disaster response. And my role in government is as a local health officer and then, you know, serving as state health officer for California was essentially the risk manager. You know, if you think about the role of the garbage disposal, where any threat that doesn't nicely fit in someone else's department fell to me. And that meant, you know, bio threats across environmental, chemical, white powder, certainly diseases and microbes, but the intersect of, you know, natural disasters like mudslides and bacteria in the mud and rapidly spreading contagions where no one knows what the heck we're dealing with. And so truly, you know, as the state health officer for California during that time, my patient was 40 million people. And so this obsession with managing risk and bio threat started very early for me. But I'm deeply grateful to people like Mark Ghilarducci, the state of California, who taught me their craft. And I'm deeply grateful when I jumped to the private sector to be taught by seasoned chief security officers, because as you know, we only make decisions as good as our scar tissue. What have we been through in the past that informs the decision we make? How fast are we going to act? What is our calculation of how bad this is going to get? And nothing replaces frontlines experience. So I'm grateful for my own frontlines experience and those who have taught me.
I'm curious, I'm sitting here thinking about a young pre-doctor Charity Dean who's maybe sitting in the backyard or reading a book or doing something. And what are these thoughts that you're having around that's like, hey, I'm really curious about biosecurity and threats and all? I mean, what was that conversation like with your mom and dad? And you're like, I'm curious about the bug or the virus.
You know, my favorite disease when I was a little girl was bubonic plague. And I used to read about Black Death and the gruesome deaths that affected, you know, millions of people during various seasons of world history. And I was obsessed with the notion of containment. Because in the and this is true for any threat. This is true for geopolitical as well. My other obsession is World War II and the actions Winston Churchill took. In containment, how fast you're able to move in the fog of war in the beginning determines if you win or lose. If you hesitate in the beginning, you've already lost. And so I loved, you know, as a little girl and as a teenager, reading about diseases that spread really fast, where a town had to reverse cordon themselves and sacrifice themselves to contain the pathogen. And, you know, when I went to college and studied microbiology, gosh, that was 1995, the world was in a different place then. So the kinds of things that were possible then are really different than today with all the advances in biotech and artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, especially as you talk about like the fog of war, or maybe the fog of let's, in this case, we're talking about maybe a fever or, you know, pandemic type situation. But as a crisis manager, as you say, a risk manager, someone who's sat at the table and you have these joint conversations, the development of what's happening right now and how should we shift our resources and action to either stay in front of it or be informed to a point at which we can make a decision. I got to imagine in your background, especially as the state lead, like, you know, you're like, if we get it wrong, we get it wrong in an exponentially terrible way. I mean, what is that like to carry that weight and think, you know, because in my mind, it requires very clear thinking. What do we know? What are we doing? Who have we told? What are our options? And at some point, we must move forward or make a decision, right?
That's right. And I used to describe my job when I was overseeing a county and then certainly overseeing the state of California. I used to describe my job as making high stakes decisions based on scattered, patchy information from unreliable sources. And if I'm wrong, I get my head chopped off and hundreds of thousands of people might die. And if I'm right, nobody knows because I've acted left of boom, mitigated the threat, and nothing happens. And I'm an adrenaline junkie, so I'll be honest, that was a great fit for me. I never needed to receive credit for being right. I hate losing even more than I love winning. And, you know, at the state of California, when the COVID threat began in January, I was very aware of it early January. I knew that this was a moment where the courage to act early and take early interventions and early controls would make the entire difference in how this rolled out. And to me and to anyone who's led security or risk, that does become a muscle memory. Acting in the fog of war amid uncertainty means you're never going to have perfect data ever, not that early. So you're going to have to piece together the data that you have in order to make directionally correct decisions. And that's what I did every day. And I launched PHC Global out of the recognition that this was software. And why didn't a biosecurity intelligence software exist to enable decision makers to be brave, to make those decisions early without having to manually gather that patchy, scattered data on their own?
Was there a moment? Well, I have two questions. I'll ask the latter one first. Was there a moment in your career in which you said, yeah, this is it. I need to go and do this. Like you said, I hate to lose more than anything. And, you know, I'm just trying to think of the tipping point personally in which you said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to create PHC. I see the need. I have a passion. Let's go continue to do what's driving Dr. Charity Dean, but let's do it at scale instead of just the state of California. Let's now expand this potentially globally to organizations. I mean, talk to me about that moment of clarity, maybe.
That moment was June of 2020. I'd been part of the team leading the California response. I'd been at the center of making the model, the trajectory of where this would go. But I knew in January exactly how this would roll out, the first week in January. And I felt like a crazy person trying to whiteboard out by hand on my whiteboard in my office to anyone who would listen. This is just math and microbiology. This is set on an inevitable trajectory, but there are things you can do now to protect your business, to protect your people. And I realized we did not have one shared situational awareness, one common operating picture. And in I hit a real low moment. I mean, I'll be honest with you. In June of 2020, I felt that this was the greatest failure of my life. I had been born to do one thing. I'd had one obsession, and that was fighting biological threats. And then our whole country had failed. The world was failing. But it was failing because it didn't have a shared intelligence tool. And let me be super clear. I did not have a background in software and artificial intelligence. And yet this capability had to exist. So my low moment was this. I'm watching businesses coming to me asking for advice. The whiplash of mask, don't mask, close, don't close. The whiplash of this will be over by April or May. And I knew this was going to go on for years. Someone had to build this shared common intelligence platform at a commercial grade scale. It existed for weather. It existed for crime. Yep. Why didn't it exist for this? So in that low moment, my conclusion was government can't build this, but the private sector can. And as I began to learn the capabilities of machine learning and artificial intelligence, I knew that this was possible. And so I committed what some felt was career suicide. And I left my career leading government and jumped into the private sector and began. I formed the company in 2020, and we began the build from scratch for a biosecurity platform that would deliver real-time shared situational awareness at global scale, would aggregate the data, would show users what are the data sources, what's your confidence in them, what's the credibility of those data sources. And at the end of the day, just enable decision makers to be brave and to act upstream. That was my goal.
I think that's great. And I can hear the passion in your voice, and almost in June, you know, when you said in June 2020, like almost the hopelessness of like, we're failing this, we're failing to get it right, because many are probably looking at it like a whack-a-mole situation or almost a binary play. Like, look, when is this going to be over? Do I wear a mask? I don't know. Yes, no. Just tell me what I need to do. And the frustration of like, you don't understand, this goes back to the bird flu. This goes back to the bubonic plague, as you said earlier. Like, these are things that are evergreen issues that that we just can't ignore anymore. I'm not saying anyone's ignoring them, but like, these need to be part of the screen that you have up saying, "What? How are we managing this? How are we looking at this?" I mean, biosecurity to a lot is probably a scary word. They think of like zombies or whatever is happening. I mean, but the risks are asymmetric now, Charity. So, you know, how does biosecurity, how does that threat vector play? How should CSOs and risk leaders be thinking about this constantly changing environment?
It's a great question. And I, because I'm in that world and the chief security officers that I work with every day have taught me a lot about what their lives were like before COVID. And here's where we are today. They now understand no one's coming to save them. The government doesn't own this risk. Actually, the enterprise owns this risk. And within the enterprise, like it or not, it is most likely the area of biosecurity going to fall to the chief security officer. It's a physical threat. And during COVID, they didn't have any tools. They had to assemble them amidst a circus where no data was available. Manually collecting information, what should we do today through human vigilance and, you know, redirecting 20 analysts. I know you were on supply chain yesterday, but today you're going to be an infectious disease epidemiologist. Can you analyze these poop samples and wastewater? It's hilarious. It really is laughable, and we laugh. But what they understand today is that they need to have biosecurity as one of those threat vectors feeding into their single pane of glass where they monitor the world, monitor all threat vectors, and they need to have the tools in place ahead of time so that never again will they have to scramble in a crisis. And what they've shared with me is their worry that chief security officers may actually be worse off when this happens again, because the C-suite is now under the impression, oh, you've got it all figured out. You went through COVID. Mm-hmm. You figured out all the solutions. Mm-hmm. And yet actually no solutions existed. And so what we've built in software is a real-time intelligence tool where our APIs can integrate right into their single pane of glass, real-time mm-hmm. intelligence, both tactical and strategic, with global data aggregation. And I think that the sentiment that I continue to see from chief security officers and the larger security intelligence ecosystem, you know, I continue to be engaged with national security and my colleagues who remain in government. Mm-hmm. And it's this: the world has changed. These threats have sped up. The impact and velocity of biological threats, it's not going to be another 100 years. We'll be lucky if it's another 18 months. Mm-hmm. As the world has changed and the global security landscape deteriorates, and as we look at the intersect of biotech and AI, here's what we know for sure. The spooky biological threats that I only fantasized about as a microbe-obsessed teenager, those exist today and they're operational. And right. as the security situation deteriorates across the globe, and you know, we won't get into NATO or politics happening, but the escalation of multiple conflicts is very concerning, that the biological threats, whether it's a natural event, whether it's an accidental lab event, or whether it's a deliberate release mm-hmm. by adversaries who would seek to harm the United States or our allies, the risk is exponentially higher today. Agreed. And nobody wants to be assembling tools or intelligence amid a crisis like they did with COVID. And that's why we exist.
We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment. But first, I wanted to tell you about the ONTX Center for Connected Intelligence. In the world of safety, security, and protection, we know that gathering and sharing information is crucial. That is why we created the ONTX Center for Connected Intelligence. The center is a hub for the ongoing exchange of security strategies and best practices, insights on current and past trends, and sharing valuable learnings through expert discussion and analysis. It's made up of seasoned experts with decades of experience across a wide range of disciplines. To find blogs, podcasts, webinars, white papers, and more, check out the center by visiting ontx.co/center. That's ontx.co/center. I mean, if you think about, look, the proliferation of information and the ability to weaponize a biosecurity matter or, make a bio issue a biosecurity issue, if you will. I'm trying to like tread lightly around this in terms of like NATO allies and the USG and whatnot. But I think you're absolutely right. I can find more information now more quickly than I ever did. Time to target is less. We now have the ability to, through drones and other ways, to asymmetrically deliver our payload, if you will. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, and many might be listening and say, yeah, but that charity chunk, that's all government. That's all like Tom Clancy geopolitical stuff. But organizations, corporations, multinationals, high net worth, they all are living within the arena that grand strategy is being played out.
Yeah.
So if I'm listening right now, I'm a chief security officer, it's like, this is great stuff. Scary. How should I consider this in the multitude of priorities and requirements that I have to deal with every day? How should I consider this, and how do I make it part of my, you know, maybe evolving war games or evolving crisis management? I mean, I remember doing like in a previous life when like we're doing the bird flu pandemic war game, and it was kind of almost like a pencil drill. But how do we make all this more real without maybe overwhelming the C-suite, Charity?
What they need to understand, and quite frankly, what they've taught me, is that biosecurity and biorisks are one threat vector of multiple intersecting threat vectors.
Right.
And the way that those vectors intersect is highly unpredictable. And let's look at climate change, natural disasters, mm-hmm. you know, air quality mm-hmm. index, heat events, how those intersect with biorisks like disease, waterborne disease, has a very practical application to business continuity. You know, I'm actually looking at our platform right now, and the intelligence alerts that have been issued around surges in dengue over the world, where in some regions, third-party vendors and supply chains have actually been crippled and temporarily shut down because of that risk to their human assets, because of the disease that, you know, closes down something that's human-run, human asset-driven. And so understanding bio threats as one threat vector that they need to have in that single pane of glass where they're monitoring multiple threats. However, when bio is driving, when it's an intersect of, you know, a flood or tsunami with disease, with geopolitical unrest, that's when it gets very dangerous for asset protection, particularly for humans, for human assets. Having the intelligence at their fingertips so they don't have to assemble it amid a crisis, it is what they want. And they have developed this tool with us. And I just want to be clear that the scar tissue that chief security officers have from all the things they've been through in the past, and COVID was just one, that's what's informing the build of this tool. Because in order to have a commercial grade shared situational intelligence, shared common operating picture, you have to incorporate the way that a chief security officer, a chief risk officer thinks. They are practical. They're tactical. They want operational plans. They want to know, just tell me, what is the threat on the ground? What is the threat to my particular assets in that locations? What controls can I put in place now? And what controls are my peers putting in place? So the intelligence has to be simple, fast, directionally correct, left of boom, but it also needs to come from experts. One of the risks of AI today is the question of who is really an expert. If you're getting notifications or push alerts or intelligence, has that been formed and reviewed by true experts that have that scar tissue from being on the front lines?
It's interesting. I think, you know, I love what you say about, like, look, we need to deliver, the end product needs to be delivered in such a way that people can make decisions. You know, I often say to get to a common operating picture, you first need common operating information, shared telemetry, if you will, common operating language. Are we all understanding this in the same language, thinking about it? You know, if you're French and I'm English, we might speak English, but I'm thinking in English, you're thinking in France. We have all these microcultural things that come in, but all that gets us to that common operating picture that should be delivered in the way that a C-suite or a business decision maker is able to look at it and say, okay, here, what are my courses of action, my options? Let's choose one. Let's go with that, as you say. And it's learned from, I love that, scar tissues.
Maybe it's because I'm a World War II history buff. I've always loved Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. One of your colleagues, chief security officer, now has me reading Sleepwalkers from World War I.
Oh,
which is very informative. But I'm going to use a war metaphor because it really applies. It's peacetime, wartime. Like, look, mm-hmm. in peacetime, when there's no big global bio threat going on, you know, my hope is you wouldn't need to use this tool every day. In peacetime, this is an insurance policy that you will have the intelligence and know what to do when something happens. In wartime, everyone needs it. And so thinking about peacetime, wartime footing, you know, for me is the right framework, enabling decision makers to be brave and lead and make directionally correct decisions amid the fog of war. In peacetime, you know that you have that intelligence available. You know, in a peacetime, wartime framework, my hope is that it's another few years before we see a global biological threat. I promise you it's not.
Well, think about this. And I love the peacetime, wartime footing. You've struck the chord in the retired lieutenant colonel in me. But I think from a business point of view, we think about investing and divesting. We know in general, historically, there's an issue. Now we're going to invest a bunch of money in that issue. And then a year, 18 months, 3 months, whatever the issue passes. Okay, well, we now need to go back and think about the bill payers and our profit loss statement. We're going to divest in things. And I think really what you're getting at is like, look, don't allow the organization to divest to the point to which it's no longer useful. Because what we should have learned from past issues or scar tissue, as you say, is like, we can't get it to the point to where we have to spin this back up. We need to keep it at a low ready, at a slow boil, so that if we need to turn the heat up on this, we're able to go and turn and say, okay, now what are we looking at? You bring up a good point about like, look, we know there's an issue. It might have a bio issue around it. That's going to affect humans, which is ultimately going to affect the supply chain, which is ultimately going to affect product or organizations, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do you see and would you encourage organizations to use that as part of their wargaming instead of just saying, hey, it's a pandemic, how are we reacting? Maybe build out more thoughtful scenarios in which we've layered in multiple risks that the organization has to fight against. And it does help us get upstream in the discussion so that if something happens, we understand the integration of risk, I guess is what I'm saying.
That's right. Yeah. So I can share how we approach this and how, you know, our partners that we work with, you know, Fortune 500 companies, colleagues that you know, how they approach this. Placing biosecurity within an ESRM framework, you know, an enterprise security and risk management framework, is incredibly useful because that framework exists, those processes exist. You know, someone is responsible for ensuring that the right intelligence in the right place at the right time is something the enterprise has to manage all kinds of risks. Very specifically, looking at duty of care, you know, the duty to have information, the duty of prevention, the duty to monitor the risks that your humans may experience, and then the duty of intervention or controls. Across that whole spectrum of duty of care, when we apply that to biosecurity under an ESRM framework, it's really clear to enterprises that bio now has to be part of their risk portfolio. And there's some really simple things that they can do. You're right. Wargaming is one of them, including bio risks in the normal processes or drills that they would go through to ensure that they're prepared, including it in duty of care, in audits of their own ability to respond. And that's why I say, you know, after COVID, it became clear to everyone in corporate security and risk management, no one's coming to save us in this space. We need to have our own tools. But many of these enterprises were really aware of that before. They had gone through some pretty high risk financial risks to their enterprise through Ebola, through H1N1, through Zika, when some of them completely shut down travel to South America. So if you just look at it from a financial business outcome return on investment, it's a no-brainer to have biosecurity included in that portfolio of risks that are under duty of care and ESRM frameworks.
I think it's interesting because we're getting beyond a point, Charity, where it's just a pencil drill of a continuity exercise. Now we're incorporating deeper measures into the discussion. Because it's, like you said, at the beginning, you know, we're creating fog of war that now makes us exercise against it. And while we may never fully get the picture, it's helping us strengthen those enterprise level decision-making muscles to say, at what point do we need to move? I mean, Colin Powell is always quick to say, if you get to 70%, you need to move because you're never going to get that 100%. So I think what you're saying is sound, especially as you start including biosecurity. You mentioned AI earlier and, you know, maybe cautions about AI in this space and all, but in general, what are you seeing as AI's role in biosecurity and biointelligence, both as something that's enabling, you know, and also as the cautionary tale?
Well, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. So can I answer that question in Star Wars?
Yeah, you can answer in Star Wars or Dune 2 or Star. Take your choice.
All right. I'm going to answer that in Star Wars. The light side and the dark side of all the advances in biotechnology is really the answer here. Look, capabilities were developed during the COVID pandemic to accelerate the development of vaccines and therapeutics, of medical countermeasures that were infinitely important. And Operation Warp Speed is one of the greatest successes that we saw in the United States during COVID. And the light side of biotech advancements is lives are being saved. Medications are being made faster at scale, at global scale. Much of that leverages artificial intelligence and machine learning. The dark side of that is the ability for any person, bad actor or otherwise, to have access to the ingredients, the instructions, the biotechnology machinery and capabilities, the information online. I'll get really specific around microbes, the libraries of the DNA and RNA and the mutations that flip a bacteria from pretty benign into really dangerous, or that flip a virus from doesn't spread human to human to spreads human to human across the globe in a matter of days. Right. The library of those mutations, all of that is at their fingertips today. And right. The advances in AI and biotech are to be celebrated, but the dark side has changed our world. The risk that will happen, the risk that game theory would dictate, someone's going to make a poor decision. And again, whether it's natural, accidental, or deliberate, that risk has exponentially increased. Right. Another light side, dark side of biotech and medicine is the proliferation of these labs. Look, a lot of people around the world are doing a lot of good work, but the proliferation of BSL-3, BSL-4 labs, and that's the biosafety levels that handle the most dangerous pathogens, has also exponentially increased. So when you have more labs and you have more research, you're going to have more accidents. You're going to have more things go wrong. All it takes is one negative pressure hood to stop working and nobody notices. All it takes is one spill, one accident. So the advances in AI and machine learning are to be celebrated. The advances in biotech are to be celebrated. But let me be clear, the world has changed. We are living in a different risk world today, where those intersecting threat vectors are going to be very unpredictable. And biosecurity should be at the top of everyone's list for what they think about with what could be the most impactful threat vectors that could take down my whole enterprise, a whole region, very quickly in a matter of days.
Oh, sure. And as you said earlier, I mean, look, with any great natural disaster, along with that comes the after effects, which includes bio issues. I mean, you think about like, hey, we have a lab, BSL level 2 or 3. I mean, what are we doing around that lab? Where is it? How are, you know, does it sit on a fault line? I mean, I think of a million questions from some past experience I've had in this space and understanding what is the threat physically and how are we mitigating against it. I mean, it's interesting. I think since you threw out Star Wars, I'll throw out I'm a Star Trek fan way back, you know, watching with my grandfather when I was a little kid, but I think there's a great quote from that series that, you know, informs all of us in this space, which is risk is our business. So you can't be afraid of it, but you have to understand it's there. It's what we do. It's what we do every day. As you said way earlier on, I think about these things and we think about how can we get upstream? How are we learning from our scars? I'm curious, as a doctor and a physician, especially in the role you are now, you know, you deal with folks like me and others who don't come from that deep experiential background that you have. We're risk folks, we're security leaders. What advice and what leadership lessons, if you'll allow me, would you give to someone like myself or someone listening in that doesn't have your background to say, look, this is what I learned as a doctor and a physician that I'd like you to know as a leader that will help you in the space and also help you lead your troops better?
Well, I'm going to go back to Star Wars again. it really holds the most meaningful leadership lessons. You know, and it was one of the later episodes where, you know, the concept in Star Wars that as the dark side rises to power, balance will be maintained in the Force. As the dark side rises, more Jedi are literally called forth to be born and rise up to keep the balance. And every leader has a mandate to be brave, but it's extremely mm-hmm. difficult to be brave unless they're equipped with the right information, the right, you know, directionally correct information, unless they're equipped with the willingness to act early amid uncertainty. The biggest leadership lesson I have ever learned as a physician, when my patient was a whole county, 460,000 people, and then my patient was a whole state, 40 million people, and I was balancing lives in the decisions I was going to make, and the information was patchy and scattered. Heck, I didn't even trust half of it. Here's what I know for sure. The willingness to lead from a place of courage that will draw the support of the team, of your allies, heck, of your enemies, because everyone is looking for someone to be brave. And that's the hallmark of leadership in these moments. It's not being the smartest one in the room. Look, there's people that are on my team way smarter than me. It's not having perfect information. It's the willingness to act to protect the whole very early on. And that takes courage. And there's no replacement for courage. Courage is not a perfect academic study with academic certainty. It's actually the opposite. Courage is acting early when the information is sketchy and there's ambiguity in the fog of war. I'll quote Braveheart. I love the movie Braveheart. There's a line in Braveheart where he says, "Men don't follow titles. Men follow courage." And I have found that to be true.
And I agree with that. I mean, there's a point at which, as a leader, you must step up and say, look, this is what we need to be thinking about now. Leaders create clarity. Leaders generate energy and they drive for results. And that all has to be done from a point of courage and a point of honor and some type of virtue if you can wrap those all into your personal style. But at some point, you're right. Somebody has to raise hands and say, hey, look, what are we thinking about here? How are we thinking about this? What are our options? And create some of that clarity so decisions can be made. Otherwise, you run the risk of organizations just literally grinding and grinding and grinding to try to get to 100% that they'll never get to. I mean, I think a superpower of security, folks, yourself included, is oftentimes our responsibility is to bring a bunch of folks together that work in different areas and try to get them to work together, joint effort, or, you know, in the military, like a purple effort, like let's bring all to the table, cyber, medical, HR, legal. And now we have to get these folks to talk, create common operating language, information, and picture to enable decisions. I mean, and that's a superpower, I think, of security leaders.
And that's what I have always called, you have to exert influence without having the authority. It's one of the hardest things to do. Influence your peers to come together for a common mission, you know, whether it's a tabletop or, you know, managing different threat vectors together, without having the authority to mandate it. It's a tricky skill, but again, you know, in my experience, it comes back to trust, integrity, leadership, courage. People follow that and they want to follow that. And being the person who says, look, guys, I am not the smartest person in the room, but no plan exists. So I'm going to make a plan. Let's come together and make it way better that we collectively together can do that. That's leadership.
Having the courage to speak up and say that, even, you're right. You know, hey, look, we don't have a plan, but we need one. So what are we doing? And I think that's a great way. And I love it. And I love the Star Wars quote. I mean, I think, often there's things we can learn from movies, you know, that are grander than ourselves. I mean, oftentimes, like, it's these grand ideas, and these grand thoughts, good, evil, light, dark, and how we're managing within those, I think that we can take away from that. And clearly you have. So I appreciate that.
Maybe you should have a whole podcast someday about corporate security leadership lessons from movies, and get a few of us guys on here, and we can just talk the whole time about movies.
We should. It would be amazing. Charity, how do people follow PHC Global? How do they find and follow you? And, you know, if people are ready to take up arms in the army of deans, how do we do that?
Well, they can find us at phcglobal.com. And they'll see on there pictures of our software tool and the intelligence that we generate and how we do it. And they can certainly get in touch with us through the website. I'm also readily available. I can be found on LinkedIn. I will be at the DSAC conference in a few weeks. Oh, I think great. It's the week of April 20th in Washington, D.C. I will certainly be there. And look forward to meeting folks, you know, come up and say hello. I love most hearing stories from seasoned security leaders about what it was like in the past and what solutions they believe are needed now, and listening to their stories, because they are the ones shaping our tool at PHC Global. This ecosystem across corporate security, national security, they're truly the ones building it. And it's been such a joy to work with them.
Absolutely. I wish when I met you at OSAC through our shared friend, I think we must have stood there for 45 minutes geeking out on all these things. So I would say if you can find time to spend a little time with Dr. Dean, please do, and get ready and bring your pencil and paper, because it will be delightful. Charity, may the force be with you.
And also with you.
Thank you so much for being on the ONTIC Protective Intelligence Podcast.
Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate it.
This episode was brought to you by the ONTIC Center for Connected Intelligence. Learn more at ontic.co/center. Again, that's ontic.co/center. It was produced by AJ McKeon. Our music is a track called Monteverde Ride, and it was written by Brian Bristow and performed by the Smokin' Novas. Check them out on Spotify. Please remember to rate and review our podcast on iTunes and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have questions, we'd love to hear them. You can reach us at podcast@ontic.co or visit ontic.co/center for more information. Thanks for listening.